The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with SuperValue Travel Insurance. Don't worry about a thing with Great Value Travel Insurance online at supervalue.ie.
And good morning, everybody. It's about 4 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Friday morning. The email address is davefanning@rte.ie. The text is 51551. And Bob Geldof, how are you, Bob?
Not bad, Dave. A bit early for you and me.
Yeah, bloody sure it is. All right, especially with the week you've had, by the way, flying all over the place. Well, I'll get to that in a second because I want to go straight into what this is all about. We just heard on the news there, Strabally County Laois. It is, of course, the electric picnic this weekend. And around tea time on Sunday, you'll be taking the stage there, which is a brilliant time, by the way, at the festival too. You being the Boomtown Rats, that is. So tell us, like from a few years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago, you were asked to play at the Isle of Wight, as in the Rats. And you went, oh, yeah, okay, we've been solo careering for a long time, but yeah, we'll do it. You had a rehearsal. Didn't go well for the first hour, then it went great. What do you get out of playing a couple of years ago, and what do you get out of playing now over the last while as well? Is it that you absolutely love being in front of a crowd and just getting in front of the band as well, or is it that you just realised, my God, the Rats are feckin' great, hadn't realised that for a long time?
The first impetus was curiosity, age, cash, always handy, the latter. It was the Isle of Wight more than anything. It's one of the great festivals. I went there when I was 19 and saw Hendrix and The Doors and The Who and Leonard Cohen when he was a young fellow. And to be asked to be on that stage, the vanity was just too much. And that was really the spur. The fact that I'd done the solo thing and still do it, and that was successful. And that's more to do with where you're at now at this stage of your life. And so go back and have, you know, were the Rats like what you thought they were at the time? And by lunchtime on the first day of rehearsal, I thought, no, this is rubbish. I mean, my main thing to the other guys was, if this is nostalgia, I'm not interested. There's ain't no rearview mirror in this car, sort of thing. And it just wasn't happening. It was, you know, tired, sort of thing. And I said it to Simon. I said at lunchtime, I said, I think this is crap. And we went back and we just went into looking after number one. And bang, whatever the Rats were right there present in that room. Suddenly it wasn't the individual guys. It was one massively powerful, coherent bit of music. And it took me aback. And the second thing was, I was not in the least bit interested in parroting words I'd written 40 years ago. But when I started singing Looking After Number One, it was the last thing. It certainly wasn't nostalgia. It was utterly contemporary. When I started singing the lines, the world owes me a living. I waited on this donkey too long. We were mired in the middle of the worst economic conditions of my life, that's for sure, and most anybody else's. And those words rang true. Mm-hmm. And we then did things like Rat Trap. And I was back in the abattoir when I wrote it in Boltsbridge, and again it rang true. If I was 19, 20 today, would that work for me? Yes. Someone's looking at you. I'd been reading on the train down to rehearsals, you know, about Obama spying on the various governments and Facebook and Google mining your data, as it's called. That is basically selling you to the highest bidder. There's something like 5,000 CCTVs all over London. So singing Someone's Looking at You, nothing had changed. 8 weeks before, some clown had just killed more people in yet another school in the United States. Why would I change a single syllable of I Don't Like Mondays? So suddenly all these things, to me, were just as relevant, and I could sing them with total conviction again. And I wanted to sing them again. And what I hadn't realized was that the songs were okay, but they probably would not have worked without that massive power of that band behind the songs pushing them out. And I hadn't twigged that, and in fact none of us had, because you're just in this thing that's happening and you're not aware of it. So walking on stage at the Isle of Wight, I'd just come from two gigs in Germany with the solo band, two huge gigs, 60,000-seater stadiums. Not for us, we were supporting the main guy. And but I walked out on stage with the Rats, and you know, it was an entirely different thing. It was joyous. Bobby Boomtown suddenly reemerged whole and entire from being asleep for a few years. And he's a different bloke completely to the guy who does the solo thing. And it was brilliant. I mean, we just killed it. And the reviews were ecstatic. And I was suddenly a Boomtown Rat again.
But Bob, when you say that, in terms of Bobby Boomtown again, when you're live on stage now, for instance, on Sunday at the Electric Picnic, do you actually become, do you think, the late 70s Geldof? Do you actually roll back the decades?
I don't become the late 70s one. I become the guy today. And, you know, as I've said before, you know, it's that snotty... you know, volatile, arrogant little shit never went away. He just got like, you know, I don't know. You know, it didn't take much for him to be suddenly reignited and let out of his cage.
Yeah.
And what it took was, I mean, I know this sounds corny and silly, but my thing was, you know, I used to leap around the stage. I mean, there's film of us at the first ever rock festival, which was in Dalymount. You know, Lizzie,
August
Philip
77,
and I were
yeah.
friends, Graham Parker, the Rats. Yeah. And there's pictures of them. I'm all over the stage. And I said to them, look, I can't do that. It's going to look ridiculous. You know, man of my age. I'm you know, it's just going to be silly and I'm not going to want to do it. So I'm going to have to work out, you know, how I represent the band, so to speak, as the front man. So I thought, what do I do? What do I feel like? So I went down to Brick Lane in London and went to these guys who sell leather, these two Indian guys. And I said, can you make me a snakeskin suit? That seemed to me to be the trigger. I was thinking of Nick Cage's scene in one of his movies where he's wearing a snakeskin jacket and he gives it to the girl. He goes, I want you to understand that this jacket represents my individual personality. And he does this big soliloquy and it's brilliant. Maybe it was that. And they said, yeah, we can make it for you. So, you know, a couple of weeks later, I pick up this mega pretend snakeskin suit. And as soon as I slipped into that not-too-worn skin, you know, suddenly I was in some other space. Now, I know that sounds corny. Bear with me. But it allowed me to do this other thing. Yeah. And... you know, Bobby Boomtown is who I describe him as. And it's very like when an actor says, like, let's say David Suchet doing Poirot, his life's work. He says when he puts on the moustache, from that point on, he's in the accent, he's in the little mincing walk, all that. And it's the same. I mean, it's corny, it's weird. I put on the suit, and bing, I'm in a whole other zone. And you walk out on stage, and contrary to what I said to the other guys, as soon as the music starts, I want to do all that stuff.
Yeah,
I really want to. In fact, it's not even thought about at all. You just go into this thing that music, for me, requires. And it is different to normal. Very nice, as you know, David, sane Bob Geldof who's talking to you now. And it's very different to Bobcat's Bob as well, the guy who does the solo stuff, which is far more internalized, far more talking to the audience. This other guy, he's sort of out of control a bit.
Well, hold on, the out of control a bit, Bob. You just mentioned earlier on there that early... I do want to get to the Rats and the importance, because a lot of people don't necessarily know just what happened between 77 and 78. I also want to play a bit of music. 51551 is our text. But you mentioned there the Isle of Wight early 70s. You were at Hendrix and The Doors and The Who and Leonard Cohen and that. But a bunch of years before that, your sister, you told me before, took you to see the Rolling Stones in Dublin. When you saw the Stones, and it was probably a pretty huge thing, did you want to be that band or did you want to be that gang?
Really good distinction there, unusual for you, Fanny.
God, I have to take this. Go on, yeah.
It, Well, she'd taken me to see the Beatles, and that was good. I was terrified because I was small, but this was just girls who I was only familiar with through my sister, but, you know, femininity abandoned, just abandoned womanhood, even though they were all kids. Just like, and it was really, the noise was unreal, just unreal. And it's true, you couldn't hear them, the Beatles, very much because the PAs were so small. And so it was kind of like a bit girly and a bit too much. Then a few months later, along come the Rolling Stones, and there were far more guys in the audience than there were women, though it was packed with screaming girls. And when they walked on stage, it was such a different thing. It was like they couldn't care less. I mean, genuinely, there was no effort to leap onto the stage and smile and go for it. They sort of noodled on and didn't say anything and, you know, took a while to plug in. And then, bam, they started. And that was it. I was gone. I mean, Mick was utterly insolent. He barely moved. He had some sort of jumper on. Keith was just looking at you and just made a sort of private grin to himself. Brian was staring up at the ceiling. Bill was somewhere, you know, and Charlie was just knocking it out. And that was it. I never saw them as Mick or Keith or Brian or whatever.
Yeah.
Immediately they presented themselves as a gang. And I didn't want to be Mick. I didn't want to be Keith. I wanted to be the Rolling Stones. I wanted to be the gang because that's what they seemed like to me. And I've never lost that, you know. I mean, I've gone to see them so many times, and bizarrely in my life I've ended up being friends with a good few of them and things. And but I've never lost that. Like, you know, that to me is, it's that. That's what it is. That otherness.
Okay. Well, look, that's the 60s. Then in the 70s you did exactly that. And there's a brilliant essay out at the moment from Joseph O'Connor where he talks about, you know, going to the Daily Mount gig and all the rest of it and just how cathartic and how important that is to him. And he goes right up to the very end of The Rats where every single release was so important. And at one stage he says, years before Mary Robinson, the divorce debate, the legislation, the legalisation of gay rights, you couldn't legally buy a condom in the late 70s. Never mind go on TV and talk blithely about getting drunk, getting laid and hating priests. You were doing all this sort of stuff. The amount of people that don't know just the doors that you knocked down around 77, 78. I want to play one song now, though, which you've mentioned already, and it's kind of pretty obvious. So The World Owes Me a Living, Waiting on the Stalky Too Long. I'll be standing there in 15 minutes. It's a quarter of a bloody hour too long. Bob, just as a matter of interest like that, what do you call it? The essay that I mentioned of Joseph O'Connor's. One thing he says about the first album, which was just like a revelation when it came out, and that was one of the reasons the doors all broke down, not least for all the other stuff, Late Lates and all the rest, was the fact that all the songs, he says, had characters in them. He could relate to every song because he could relate to the real people in them. Did you even realise that when you were doing the album, or did that just, is that just the way it came out?
No, I didn't realise it. What I did think needed to be done, and again, remember, you're a bunch of kids out of Dunleary, was that I immediately thought, and this, I suppose, is sort of youthful arrogance, it kind of still is, really, I immediately thought in a line with, you know, Van, Lizzie, Rory, and we would fit in there somewhere. I dismissed out of hand the local Dublin bands who were around at the time, albeit good, like Cheap Thrills, who were a country rock outfit, Supply, Demand and Curve, Jazz Fusion, couldn't stand it, Nightbus, a really good band, who sort of Little Feet, kind of grooves and funk, but it just was meaningless to me. And so it was deliberate that we go back to that which we completely understood as kids, because we tried in our first rehearsal doing a couple of other pieces by other bands, but it was all over the place, and suddenly we launched into rhythm and blues and we all nailed it. But for some reason, and I've never quite understood this, we played it much faster than either Muddy Waters or the Rolling Stones version of Muddy Waters. It seemed to demand that. And whereas Van, who is peerless in most people's views and mine, and I think the singular Irish genius in Irish music, without question, I think you won't get any argument from any of the other players, he was dealing in some other realms completely, of sort of Celtic mysticism and using this beautiful language, and it seemed to utterly automatic, which is daunting. Philip was doing a sort of Celtic romanticism. If you look at all the album sleeves, the Fitzpatrick album sleeves, Roisin Dubh, you know, these sort of references to a romantic Ireland. You know, Rory was trying to find an authenticity. I'd seen him at the Isle of Wight at about 2 p.m. with Taste, and really took the day. He was just brilliant. And I just thought that none of that deals with the reality of my life and, you know, waiting in that dole queue in Dunleary, the door not being opened. I remember in the bitter rain of November, these 40-year-old men without a job, through no fault of their own, the civil servants inside having their cup of tea, meant to open at 9, keeping us all waiting outside. They were on a cushy number with their pensions. And I still have that, you know, unemployment slip with those words written on it. So, where, you know, I thought I'd write about the reality of being in Ireland at that moment. And, you know, so there were people around who I could pin this stuff on Joey's on the Street Again. He was a real person. Never Bite the Hand That Feeds. I was just, that's a girl I knew who went off with this guy. And so it wasn't like putting names like Sandy Cove and place in South Dublin, you know, taking the cue from Van that you could take where you lived, like, say, Belfast, which I always thought was, you know, a crap town. And suddenly, you know, it gives it light and it makes it explicable. And I consciously went out to write about, look around and write about the Dublin I knew, because it wasn't the Dublin I was reading about, but it would be the Dublin I was experiencing.
And the Dublin you knew and the Ireland you knew, you got a platform to do some things about that in terms of being on the stage and in terms of the importance of what the Late Late was in the late 1970s and that. Like, when you were on the Late Late and you were being castigated by the front row and even Gay was being slightly patronising, even though he was definitely letting you do what you wanted to do, absolutely perfect, there was also, like, later on where you weren't allowed to play in Ireland, where the Pope's tent wasn't allowed to be used and you had to play in leagues. Did you just say, to hell with this stupid shagging country and write Banana Republic?
Yeah, it was the final straw, because we got to number one in the UK. Now, the thing is that what really happened was that the Brits never understood that we were a specifically Irish band. That was key. And so we come to England in 76. Now, we cranked up almost exactly 40 years ago today in Bolton Street in the Classroom. That was the first gig. And so we had a year of, you know, getting it together in Ireland. I just thought we got to break out of Dublin. So myself and Billy McGrath and a couple of others set up the first Irish rock tour. Fucking O'Kelly was there and helping in that. And, you know,
the Falling Asunder tour, I remember.
Yeah, I booked the National Stadium, like, you know. We just got to do it. It doesn't matter if there's three people. We've got to say we played the National Stadium. So, you know, so anyway, we did that, and it all worked. And so by the time we arrived in the UK, we pretty much had our chops down, as they say. Yeah. And at that moment, there was this massive explosion of children in England who'd had enough. The English economy was being driven right into the wall. Now, the difference between us and the British was that we were talking about a sort of need. There has to be a cultural change. We cannot remain in this sort of infantile state dictated by an overweening church, an indifferent state government and opposition, and the police behaving with impunity. We cannot go on like that. That was, you know, what we were crapping on about at the Late Late and on record was there needed to be a change. The country needed to assert itself. In the UK, it was a totally different situation. There was an economic condition where there were no jobs available. So you had these brilliant, as it turns out, Irish people like Johnny Lydon, who, you know, could sum it up very deftly. And we arrive in the middle of this, or just before it explodes, and we look like them. We're slightly older, not much, but we're viewed with great suspicion. It looks like, hold on, they can play. And, you know, they look like us. They're slightly older, but they can play. So what the Rats turned out to be, in my view, was the gap between the pub rock bands, i.e. you can be a star just in your local pub. Mm. You don't have to have platform shoes and limousines and big mansions. You can play amazing, proper rock star music, but just wear your normal clothes in a pub. And the punks, which wanted to destroy, quite rightly, everything, and they did. So in that gap were these young guys from South Dublin who were essentially a pub band, yeah, but playing faster than Dr. Feelgood and looking something like what the Brits turned out. So they viewed us with great suspicion. But when our music came out there, it had a similar effect as in Ireland. There's a great book out by this journalist in Australia, who's from Indian parents. And she was very disenfranchised. She was a teenager, but her parents didn't understand that she was an English teenager. They were insisting on Indian family virtues. And she was using the Rats' music as a way to assert her identity. And she had to keep it hidden in her wardrobe. She had posters of, you know, pop star Bob and the lyrics written across her bed. And her father came in and went completely ballistic and scratched out the words. And, you know, she wrote about that and what it meant to her, which, of course, as you get older, is flattering. You don't realize you have that impact. But the impact for children of 13 and 14, especially disenfranchised people from another culture, what's it, for the Rats, was meaningful. And so we did slot in, ultimately, with the Clash, with the Pistols, with the Jam, and in particular with the Ramones and Talking Heads. We did our first gigs with those two guys in schools at about 4 p.m. in the afternoon in gymnasiums. Our first gigs in Britain were with the Ramones and Talking Heads. That was something.
Yeah, I'd say it was. You went in the middle and the Ramones came last or something, and nobody got the
Nobody
rock.
Could follow the Ramones. Yeah. I mean, we started off saying, well, look, let's each take turns going first.
Yeah.
And in front of us were these, like, 13, 14-year-old mullet-headed Bay City Roller fans with, you know, mud on their T-shirts.
Well, they were going to get the Rats, but they weren't going to get the art rock of Talking Heads, I can tell you that.
No.
Listen, I'll tell you what, we're going to play a song that I said, The Two Fingers Up to Ireland, if you like, and there's a 2,000 text there, 51551. Let's play Banana Republic. Bob, I just want to mention, we're talking to Bob Geldof, just want to mention a few of the texts here, specifically as regards the Rats and this weekend, etc. Because my daughter is heading to Electric Picnic today, and I've advised her, in inverted commas, not to miss the Rats on Sunday evening. It'll be the highlight. I'm so jealous, says Anita. I love listening to Bob Geldof, one of my heroes. Just dropped my 19-year-old daughter off to get the bus to Electric Picnic, and thinking how lucky these kids are to get the opportunity to hear Boomtown Rats and experience the great music and lyrics that we enjoyed. I mean, Bob, like the audience that goes to see you, obviously on Sunday, at tea time on Sunday at the thing, like they're going to be maybe of an age, most of them will never have seen the Rats. I've just heard about the Rats. Do you like that kind of challenge, saying, well, listen, this is how good we were?
Yeah, is the answer. I mean, because I didn't know we were that good. That's the honest to God truth. Yeah. I mean, certainly no one at home got it. You know, Hot Press were, they were kind of supportive, but given that Niall Stokes had his own country rock outfit, he didn't really twig. And there was no pattern that they could get a cultural fix on, because punk hadn't happened yet in Britain. So we weren't really punk, but we weren't what they were doing. And certainly, you know, my carry-on drove everybody nuts. They just thought, like, they couldn't stand me. So that was Bobby Boomtown, like, in excelsis sort of thing. And it did come to a head, to your earlier point, which I didn't really answer. It came to a head with Banana Republic. Rat Trap was number one. It was the first ever Irish rock and roll number one. Not only that, it was the first of the new wave number ones.
Yeah.
And, you know, we go on RTE, and I'm, as you know, not in the least bit nationalistic. I can't stand it. But I am proud of being Irish. That's a different thing. And, you know, if you look at that on YouTube or something, I'm wearing a tiny little tricolour in my lapel. And, you know, I just thought this is a victory for this other generation. And we come home to Ireland, and largely we are purposefully prevented from playing our own country. Now, if you were 18, 16, 17, 18, 19, you know, I'm sure you shared in our sense that, yeah, we've done something. We're Irish. We made, that's it. We're in the UK. I'd live my life according to the UK charts, and here we were. And there was this concerted effort to stop, let's remember, a pop band from Dunleary from playing here. Every time we tried to play, we were booked into Leopardstown Racecourse for two nights. Yeah. The insurance was taken away so that we couldn't allow people in for safety fears. Every time that we went to court, we were knocked back, we were knocked back. Eventually, what's it, you know, the Archbishop, I think, of Galway got up and started railing against us. We were debated in the Dáil where we were a disgrace. I have a letter from John Stevenson, who was doing an exhibition called The Sense of Ireland, where he'd written to one of the banks and saying, could they have sponsorship? And I have the letter saying, unfortunately, we don't have any sponsorship budget at the moment, but if you think that we'd sponsor that, you know, the Boomtown Rats, you have another thing coming. And this was going on. Now, please, put this in perspective. Here are the hierarchy of an entire country deciding that these six children, in effect, could not play in their own country. Banned, not from a gig, but from your country. That is ridiculous. And so Ireland was the first stop of our conquering world tour. And so we just said, we're not leaving until we play in our own country. We're not leaving. So we holed up in Bloom's Hotel, cancelled America, cost us every penny we had, and eventually Desmond Guinness gave us Leixlip Castle for £10,000, Mark, mind you. And the crew went out and dug the toilets. The local rugby club said they do security. RTE announced, if you have tickets for Leopardstown, get to Leixlip by tomorrow night. They announced it at 1 minute past 12 on a Friday night because the courts wouldn't sit after on Friday night. And I thought 10 people would show up. We'd have done what we said. We're out of here. In fact, as you know, 25,000 showed up. Rickety stage. There was a lot of carry-on in the front. But it didn't matter. I mean, looking out that morning at down on the quays and seeing thousands of kids who had just left home when they twigged, when the word got around, this is a day before, time before social media, they just packed something in their bag after midnight, left home from all over the country, got to Dublin by early morning, got on the hundreds of buses that took you out to Leixlip. And there's news footage of me sitting on the wall and I think fingers and a couple of others saying, like, welcoming everyone. And I did feel a shift. I know this sounds, you know, monumental at that, but I did feel a shift. Something had snapped at that point, and it was a little victory, but I was so fed up. I went straight to the airport after the gig, and I slept at the airport until we got the first plane out, and that was Banana Republic.
No, but hold on, Bob, it was a big victory, because all the little victories had been happening the few years before that, with the other little things you did, waking people up all over the place, including the lead singer of U2, looking in Clontarf, going, wow, this guy on top of on the Late Late Show, what's he up to? But isn't just a couple of things I want to mention here, which is, there's one here that says, look, there's so many texts. Hi, Dave, Bob and the Rats. Bob and the Rats, they nailed the real mood of late 70s, early 80s Ireland, and even today their lyrics ring true. And that's from Dave and Athai. And there's just one I want to mention here, because I mentioned Joe O'Connor earlier on. I'm just wondering if this is from Joe, and he just says it straight out. He says, Bob's style of songwriting with the Rats and later on his life story influenced me to such an extent that my love of writing is still with me, and all my writing is character based. There's one thing about you though, Bob, like, in terms of bringing the Rats back now from 2013, Isle of Wight, etc. Your life in music has been overshadowed by other lives, like anti-poverty to personal life, etc. And you've talked about the fact that your family is part of the national soap opera in the UK, whether you want it or not. You are ready in the next scene before you realise it, all that kind of thing. Is it just great to get back with the Rats? I know I've asked that at the very beginning, but I want to kind of ask it again to just make you feel just great on stage.
Yeah, is the answer. I mean, seriously, look, Dave, how long we've known each other, I would absolutely say to you and everyone listening, yeah, it's okay. You know, it's a bit of laugh. It's not. It's great. I mean, it is seriously an amazing band. I mean, I'm really serious. I'm bigging it up. I'm in that band, and you're in song 3-4, and you're just lost in this power. I mean, seriously, like, you know, I didn't know Roberts, you know, BP Fallon. You know, he came to the gigs and he said, you know, man, I've forgotten how vulgar Gary's guitar is. And that's right. There's this glorious vulgarity that really doesn't take prisoners. And it's like Simon is, like all drummers, quiet and very solid. And he just sits there smiling to himself. And what's he smiling about? And of course, it's just a deep satisfaction that you're in something great. And that is not to say, like, you know, I've just played in Naples night before last.
Yeah.
And that was with the Bobcats, the solo band. I call it that this year. I'll change the name to something else. And that's a different thing. So it's to your point about the soap opera. The solo stuff deals with Bobcats, Bob, if you like. So there's Bobby Boomtown, Bobcat, and then there's the guy talk to you now. And I know this sounds really, you know, actory and a bit wanky and all that, but bear with me. The guy who's doing that talks more, it's much more internalized. It's to do with the stuff you talked about, the soap opera, I guess, because I write, you know, you constantly write songs, and the songs I write now are in a similar vein, but they're more about the life as it continues. The rat stuff is a complete catharsis. It isn't cathartic being doing the Bobcats. It's an amazing band, amazing musicians, but it's expressing something that's somehow to do with now and needs to be almost, vomited out. The rats is completely opposite. It's cathartic to the nth. I leave stage physically ruined, exhausted. Mentally, I'm in a clear zone. So it wipes my brain. And, you know, memory crowds me all the time. It, like anybody else, it assails you out of the blue. Walking down the street, you buckle with some memory that for no reason and unwanted attacks you. And with the Bobcats, I'll sing a song and suddenly what sparked it is there, and it's difficult to get through. With the rats, there's plenty of memory in the song, but it's so pointed and focused and directed out, it's so externalized, that by the end of it, it's like I've scrubbed my brain clean and I feel naturally up. Not high, not out of control, but up and happy, and but clean and clear. And so the need to do this, pathetically, the need to do this is essential. And that's why I suppose I love it.
And the walking down the street and buckling, as you call it, and then maybe going into, you know, I don't know, a laneway to do a blub. I mean, the private life in terms of, like, how's that, like, do you forget it all on stage and you're just Bobby Boomtown, I suppose, is really what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yes, okay. I do. It allows me to do that.
Okay, by the way, look, like, I mean, back in the 1980s, obviously everybody knows from the mid-80s, you saw Michael Burke on the television,
yeah,
and you realised something had to be done. You jumped up out of your seat and said, we've got to do something. You did Band Aid, Live Aid, and the history is all there. And I'm reading from the headlines of just this morning's papers. I've got two here. They are Independent, a drowned toddler, the harrowing symbol of EU's migrant crisis, and the Guardian, the shocking, cruel reality of Europe's refugee crisis. Like, I mean, in terms of just, like, do you just look upon that as a dad, or look upon that as maybe something you could do, or something you've done before that you could do again, or what way do you see it?
I look at it with profound shame and as a monstrous betrayal of who we are and what we wish to be. That's what I looked at. We are in the moment, currently now, a moment that will be discussed and impacted upon in 300 years' time, a fundamental shift in the way the world has worked for the last, say, 600 years. Power has been sucked out of the West and moved East. Technology, once it met money and was multiplied by human greed, collapsed the world economy. If there's a new economy, there needs to be a new politics. There isn't. And it's the failure of that new politics has led to this fucking, this disgrace, this absolute sickening disgrace. And late last night, you know, I couldn't get my head around this, so about 12:30 I started banging out this piece. And I said, okay, let's take on now. Let's put our money where our mouth is. So I am prepared. I'm lucky. I've got a place in Kent. I've got a flat in London. Me and Jan would be prepared to take three families immediately in our place in Kent and a family in our flat in London immediately and put them up until such time as they can get going and get a purchase on the future. I cannot stand what is happening. I cannot stand what it does to us. You know, for I've known and you've known and everyone listening knows is that the bollocks we talk about our values are complete nonsense. You know, once it comes home to roost, you know, we deny those values. We betray ourselves. But those values are correct. And it happens time and time and time again. And so we are better than this. We genuinely are. And I don't want to drag you back to the rats, but, you know, that night on the Late Late where Bono and Gavin Friday were looking at the show and went, what is this? And, you know, Joe O'Connor and various others were going, yes, yes. You know, the point about Ireland at that point, I said to Gay Byrne, is that I always viewed Ireland as a sort of deep-diving whale that every Friday night was allowed to come up and vent for 2 hours and then go back down again, pushed back down again. And in those 2 hours, you saw an elegance, an intellectualism, a humanity, you know, a maturity that wasn't allowed by the powers that be then. And eventually, of course, you know, made itself known and felt. The same is true now. You know, I do understand, of course I understand the economics and the politics. Ah, yeah, but if we let some in, more will come. All right. All right. I do understand when Cameron says the root cause of this must be addressed. Yes, it must. But we are in a period of fundamental shift. 12 years ago, I was in Lampedusa, the island where first, you know, the people arrived from North Africa. And I was with the mayor. And we went to a refugee camp. Because he told me every morning he woke up to the sight of men, women and children dead on the rocks around Lampedusa. So I started talking about this. Of course, the Daily Mail, you know, were scathing and derogatory and saying, Geldof, you know, doesn't know what he's talking about. They rang the mayor of Lampedusa, who immediately denied he'd ever met me. But it was happening then, because when people are poor, they move. I am an economic migrant. Britain accepted me, and let me get on with it. I couldn't do it in Ireland, which made me very bitter about Ireland, but made me eternally grateful to the British people for saying, get on with it, dude, and I did. The same is true of thousands of Irish, millions in America, Australia, Britain, everywhere else. This is happening again, except it's people fleeing war, not famine, or economic hardship. That will increase as the environment decays. The environment makes people move from one area of a resource to another. It's happening and has happened all over Africa. For 40 years, Dave, 30 years, I've been dealing with refugees. Last year, I was on the border of Somalia and Ethiopia, like with the refugees from the Somalian war. You know, all of this is happening now. We must have the politics and the humanity to deal with it. It makes me sick, and a concert won't do it.
All right, Bob, listen, it's been a pleasure to have you on the programme this morning. Thanks a million for talking to us. Tea time Saturday to get back to supposedly, I suppose, more mundane matters is going to be the great gig. And look, if you see all the texts coming in here, I mean, I could write a blinking book. Not one saying you're a bit of an arrogant bastard, which I like. Okay, anyway, listen, thank you very much, Bob, for all that. Fair play to you. And Sunday tea time around 5 o'clock at the Electric Picnic. It starts today, so it's Friday, Saturday and Sunday. It's the Boomtown Rats in concert. And wherever you are in those fields, make sure you go and take a look at them. Bob, thanks a million for talking. I was going to play a little bit of Rat Trap and then take a break. See
cheers,
you, Bob.
Dave.
Good luck.
Bye-bye, Bob.